Okay, good morning, it's Bio 241 and it's April 14th. And did you guys have a test last time? And okay, so we didn't have a lecture last time. You'll get your test back in lab, of course, today. You can look them over. I think a class in general did excellent. Probably, I would say, I didn't really look at this, but maybe more than half the class got A's on this test, so that's really good, so congratulations. I didn't think it was a particularly easy test, so even though there are a lot of students that got A's, it doesn't diminish probably the effort and work you put in to get that kind of grade, so congratulations to everybody. And since we're talking about tests, we're supposed to have a test a week from this Thursday, and so I'll see how that goes. I'm not really sure. It's going to be on two chapters, so it just might be on muscle and blood, maybe not cardiovascular system, and maybe I won't even know until Thursday. All right, so you just got to keep coming to lecture to find out. Okay, don't forget on your Scantrons, no stray marks, things like that, so you don't confuse the Scantron reader, because one of these days you're going to be taking tests and you never get the Scantron back, and you're just going to be shooting yourself in the foot if you're not careful marking those Scantrons out. All right, so take a look at your Scantrons and look over the questions. All right, so does anybody have any questions about muscle? As a matter of fact, can anybody even remember what a muscle is? Because we were talking about that way before spring break and before the last test even. Okay, so what's a muscle? What's muscle specialized to do? Contract. All right, good. There's some people out there. Fantastic. And how many different kinds of muscle are there? Yeah, there's actually three major kinds, right? There's skeletal, cardiac, and smooth muscle. And you have to learn some of the differences between them, and we've been talking a lot about skeletal muscle so far. And what is the novel thing about skeletal muscle? It sets itself apart from everything else in your body. It's voluntary. Is nothing else voluntary? I don't understand. As a matter of fact, you should say, yeah, it is the only thing that is voluntary in your body. That's the only thing you have control over is skeletal muscle. Okay, so we looked at excitation, contraction, coupling. What's the chemical signal that floods the interior of a myofibril that signals for contraction? Yeah, the flood of calcium, right? And what does calcium bind to initiate sliding of the myofilaments? Yeah, it binds to troponin in skeletal muscle, troponin, and then that allows for cross bridges to form and sliding of the actin and myosin myofilaments. All right, and then I think we were just beginning to look at some tension measurements. So what we have here on the screen is a plot of, and when you look at graphs, make sure you always know what the axes are labeled as. All right, so this is a plot of, we have been looking at what, electrical activity versus time, but is this electrical activity versus time on this graph right here? It's not labeled on this slide. This is a graph of, okay, yes, it's good I'm mentioning that. It's a measure of tension that's developed by a muscle when it contracts versus time. All right, so a twitch is actually a measure of contraction or the amount of tension that a muscle or a muscle fiber can produce. All right, and what do you notice about these twitches right here? Contrast what you see with what you know about action potentials. Yeah, these twitches are summating, so twitches don't always reach the same amplitude. If they occur close enough in time, they can summate, and that's just due to the residual amount of calcium that's left over inside the myofibril before all of those actin and myosin filaments slide back to their resting position. All right, so twitches can summate. Action potentials can't. All right, so what we see right here, if we increase the frequency of stimulation of a muscle electrically, I'd actually like to do this in lab, but we don't have any stimulators in lab to measure this kind of thing. But if we were to stimulate a muscle with 5 shocks per second, look what would happen to that muscle. It would contract and then start to relax, right? But before full relaxation takes place, what happens? It would contract again, right? So these twitches would summate, and the peak tension would slowly walk up like this stairway right here, and this is sometimes what we call trepe. right? And so all of these muscle twitches will summate, but eventually it will reach a maximum force of contraction right here, all right? But it will still experience some periods of relaxation. But if we increase the frequency of excitation on these muscles, notice that there is just a shorter period for relaxation before the muscle contracts once again. And so we see TREPA happening, and this is still what we call incomplete tetanus, because the muscle is still relaxing a little bit before the next stimulation comes. In this first case over here, you see what? Even a greater incomplete tetanus, you see more relaxation that is occurring before the next stimulus is applied. But if we increase this to 60 shocks per second, notice what happens to the muscle. All right, it just shoots up, and we don't see any staircase right here, and the muscle never relaxes. We call this complete tetanus. And what can you tell me about electricity in our buildings? What frequency is the electricity that we use to power our buildings? Okay. Yeah, it's 120 volts, so it's pretty high voltage. All right, but it is at 60 cycles per second. All right, and what would happen to skeletal muscle if you were to stimulate, if you were to touch electrical wires in the building? What would happen to muscles? Would it go into incomplete tetanus or complete tetanus? Complete tetanus. That's exactly right. It just so happens that 60 cycles per second is one of the most damaging frequencies to human tissue, and it's also kind of funny that that's the frequency at which power is transmitted to our buildings. Engineers figured that that was the best way to electrify our buildings. Unfortunately, it is also what the most efficient way of electrifying ourselves. All right, so don't mess around with the electricity unless you know what you're doing inside buildings. All right, but if we keep the stimulation on, what happens to that muscle? It can't stay contracted forever. It starts to fatigue, right? So even though it's being stimulated and muscles will try to contract, the force of contraction will decrease over time until we turn that stimulation off. All right, and that's due to an accumulation of potassium outside the cell, and that disrupts the membrane potential. It might also be due to a change of pH inside the cell. It might be due to a buildup of ADP inside the cell. ADP is produced when ATP is hydrolyzed. And it might also be due to the buildup of lactic acid inside the cell. So a number of effects, okay, but not necessarily a decrease in ATP. All right, so when this muscle is in tetanus right here, if this ever happened to you, and you probably experienced this, maybe you've had a muscle cramp, for instance, and did we talk about this before we left last time? Maybe. All right, what does that feel like when that muscle contracts, when it goes into complete tetanus? Hurts like hell. Very good. I did talk about that, because when a muscle, which is a kind of a fluid tissue, when it contracts, it turns into a solid, and then, of course, blood can't get into that muscle, and then that muscle is starved for oxygen, and mitochondria cannot produce ATP, and then the muscle goes to anaerobic respiration, starts to produce a lot of lactic acid, and it's very painful. Okay. So that's not anything that you would look forward to. Okay. Here's an important concept that you should learn about skeletal muscle, but this is also going to be a very important concept for cardiac muscle. It has major implications on how we treat cardiac patients, depending on what condition they're in, and that is the length tension relationship in muscle. All right, so again, if you were going to describe to somebody how a muscle actually shortens, what would you use as a model to describe how a muscle shortens? Yeah, the sliding filament theory, right? The actin and myosin sliding over each other, pulling the Z-discs together. All right, so I want you to always keep that in the back of your mind. The length tension relationship in a muscle just says that the strength of a muscle contraction is influenced by a couple of things, right? We saw what? The frequency of stimulation, because skeletal muscle can summate, right? The thickness of each muscle fiber. Don't forget, a muscle fiber is a cell. The bigger the diameter of the muscle cell, that means more myofibrils inside the cell, means there's more filaments inside the cell, so you have a greater mechanism by which tension can be developed. And then, just as important, is the initial resting length of the muscle fiber. All right, so there is an ideal resting length that can optimize the amount of tension that can be produced when that muscle contracts. So if you stretch a muscle out, it gets very weak. If you let a muscle shorten before it contracts, it is also going to produce a very weak contraction. And how are we going to understand that? Okay, so here is a plot of tension versus the percent resting length of a muscle. All right, so this is just going to be the tension that is produced as we do what? As we stretch a muscle fiber. All right, and we can see that there is an optimum, right, around 100% resting length, right? And if we stretch it, guess what happens to the muscle? It gets weaker and weaker and weaker. Or if for whatever reason, because of elastic properties of the muscle, if we allow it to shorten before it starts to contract, then it won't be able to develop the same amount of tension either. So how are we going to understand that? Well, if we look down in this area of the curve, this ascending limb of the length tension relationship, and think of a sarcomere, let's think of a sarcomere where what? The Z discs come closer together. They start to approximate each other. All right, and when that happens, look what happens to the overlap between the actin and myosin. They're completely overlapped. Moreover, right, look at the myosin molecule compared to the overall length of the sarcomere. The myosin molecule makes up the whole length of the sarcomere. So can the sarcomere contract anymore? It can't, because the Z-disc is going to bump into the myosin molecule, and there's no way. So these cross bridges might be able to cycle, right, and to pull on the on these Z-discs right here, but it can't develop any more tension. Right, so how do we improve the contractile properties of this sarcomere? Well, before we ask it to contract, let's stretch it out a little bit. All right, so now we move the Z-discs away from the ends of the myosin molecules, but there still is some overlap between these myosin head groups and actin. Now we stimulate the muscle, and can these Z-discs be pulled closer together? Absolutely, right, because the actin and myosin can now slide over each other. There's still sufficient overlap before the muscle contracts between actin and myosin. And this is the condition in which we get the optimal amount of tension produced from a muscle. But now let's, before we ask this muscle to contract, let's look at a third condition. Let's stretch this sarcomere out to a great degree, maybe 160%. And now what can you tell me about the overlap between actin and myosin? There is no overlap. So is there any way for these filaments to slide over each other? No, because you need to have myosin head groups form a cross bridge to an actin molecule. And as the head groups reach up to grab hold of actin, if there's no actin there, then of course there can't be any motion. All right, so a muscle has to have this optimal resting length in order to contract with optimal tension. If it's too short, it won't work, it can't contract, and if it's stretched out too much, actin and myosin can't slide over each other. All right, so this is what we call the length-tension relationship. This is the ascending limb of the length-tension relationship, and then this is the descending limb, and where you would like to have your muscles operating is right in this region here. And it's the same thing for the heart as well. All right, so this is why a lot of athletes perform certain kinds of stretching exercises, all right, so that they put their muscles right in this optimal region for developing strength. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about neural control of skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle needs nervous or innervation in order to contract. Skeletal muscle shouldn't contract on its own unless maybe it's damaged somehow or inappropriate diet that produces a cramp, something like that. All right, so you need motor neurons. And how many motor neurons does it take to go from the cerebral cortex? And as a matter of fact, you might want to remember what part of the cerebral cortex can initiate skeletal contraction, skeletal muscle contraction. What gyrus is that? You should probably know what gyrus that is. Okay, that's the precentral gyrus in the frontal lobe. That's the primary motor cortex. And so how many neurons does it take to get from the premotor cortex all the way down to a skeletal muscle to actually cause that muscle to contract? You know what? There's only two. That's right. There's an upper neuron and a lower motor neuron. All right, so the first one goes all the way from the cortex down through the internal capsule. That's between what, the basal nuclei and the thalamus, down into the spinal cord. And it goes all the way down to the level of the spinal cord where it synapses on the lower motor neuron, which then leaves the spinal cord. How does that lower motor neuron leave a spinal cord? How do signals get in and out of a spinal cord? Through a root of some kind, right? Is it a dorsal root or a ventral root? It's the ventral root, which is the motor root. So the lower motor neuron leaves the ventral root, and it goes all the way to that skeletal muscle that it is innervating. Okay. Oh, it says right here, ventral root. Okay. All right, so the lower motor neuron is what we call the final common pathway, because things can influence, besides your primary motor cortex, how a muscle is going to contract. It's influenced by sensory feedback from muscles and tendons themselves, right? And it can be facilitated or inhibited by activity from other upper motor neurons, like maybe you change your mind when you start to make a motion to do something, right? Okay, so what do we call things that can measure tension in muscles and tendons, and also angulation of joints? There are certain receptors that you have in all your muscles and tendons and joints that give your person a sense of where your body is located and what kind of tension is being produced and if it's appropriate or not. That's right, proprioceptors. Okay, proprioceptors are special tension receptors in muscles. We call those spindle apparatus. There are things in tendons that we call Golgi tendon organs or bodies. And there are things in joint capsules that measure tension as well. All right. So before you make any kind of motion, your premotor cortex is sending signals out saying, okay, we're going to move a part of your body. And then it elicits help from the cerebellum. The cerebellum knows how to do some of these things because probably you've done them before, like maybe standing up from a chair, for instance. You know about how much muscle contraction you need from your legs and from your back muscles, and the cerebellum programs all this information, sends information to the skeletal muscles to perform that activity, right? And so, for instance, if you're going to stand up right now, your cerebellum knows how much to contract your leg muscles so that when you stand up, you don't do what? You don't, like, hop over the desk in front of you because you're using too much muscle strength, right? You know just about the right amount of tension to do that, right? But what happens if someone were to, like, put their hand on your shoulder as you were standing up, right, and push down? Well, that would be an error signal. And again, there are certain mechanisms in your body that would take that into account and try to correct for that error. Or maybe if you're standing up and then somebody helped you up off the chair, right, your cerebellum would automatically start making corrections so, again, you wouldn't be, like, thrown over the tabletop, right? So there are things that the cerebellum knows how much tension a muscle should develop, but it always keeps track to see if indeed that's what's happening. And if it's not what's happening, it makes corrections so that you don't hurt any joints or stretch any muscles. Okay, so muscle length, actually strength, is always measured by the spindle apparatus and Golgi tendon bodies or organs and other organs that are in joint capsules. So here's a muscle spindle apparatus. I'm not going to ask you to know a lot about a muscle spindle apparatus, except that it is a modified skeletal muscle cell. All right, so here we see, where I have the cursor right here, what would you call this histological structure right here? What does that look like to you? That just looks like a normal skeletal muscle cell. You see all the striations. This is the kind of muscle cell that produces tension that you use for moving your body around or for posture, things of that nature. And it is innervated by, just somatic motor neurons. And the motor neurons that go to these normal muscle fibers are called alpha motor neurons. All right. Here is a muscle spindle apparatus. And these right here, if you look maybe down on the ends of this muscle, you can see striations. And this one over here, it's hard to see striations. But these are just modified muscle cells. But these really don't produce tension for your body, but they do contract. All right. So the normal skeletal muscles are what we call the extrafusal fibers, right? And I see some extrafusal fibers over here. And the fibers that are inside the muscle spindle apparatus are what we call intrafusal fibers. There's a couple different kinds. I'm not going to ask you to know the different kinds of intrafusal fibers, but you should at least know there's intrafusal and extrafusal. And the Intrafusal fibers are innervated by motor neurons as well, but these are what we call gamma motor neurons. All right, so alphas go to the extrafusal, gamma go to the intrafusal fibers. All right. Now, the other thing about the intrafusal fibers is that they do have sensory receptors that can measure the amount of stretch of the intrafusal fiber. Right, and I'm not going to ask you to know the different kinds, right? There's a primary and secondary fiber right here, but these send information about stretch of this spindle apparatus to the spinal cord and then eventually to the cerebellum, right? So if there is an error in the length or the amount of tension that's being produced by this muscle, that error signal is going to be sent by the spindle apparatus to your central nervous system, and the central nervous system will then make a decision on what to do with that information. All right, so that's the muscle spindle apparatus. I think I've talked about all these. So don't forget the alpha go to the extrafusal fibers and the gammas go to the intrafusal fibers. All right, so how does this system work? Okay, and it works by a principle that we call co-activation. All right, so let's just go back to, this figure right here. All right, and let's just say that both the extrafusal and intrafusal fibers right here, or this muscle that all of these fibers are in, is not contracting. It's just at rest. And then your body asks it to do a job, so the muscle starts to contract. All right, so there are action potentials that go down, what, the alpha motor neuron to the extrafusal fibers to cause the extrafusal fibers to contract. All right, but then what happens to the tension on these intrafusal fibers, right? If they stay the same length and these start to contract, then these fibers right here are what? Really long, right? As these shorten, these are really, really long. And so there's no tension that's developed on the intrafusal fibers whatsoever, okay? So if the muscle then starts to stretch, maybe the weight is too heavy and the muscle starts to stretch, it's going to stretch the extrafusal fibers, but if these intrafusal fibers are really long, right, if they're just weak and they start to stretch, does tension change in them at all? Okay, say if I have, how about if I have a rubber band? When do I increase tension on a rubber band? Ah, here's a rubber band. All right, so let's just pretend that this rubber band right here are the intrafusal fibers. And the extrafusal fibers on either side of the rubber band have contracted, and it takes the tension away from the rubber band. Okay, so what can you tell me about the tension of the rubber band? It's basically zero, right? So the intrafusal fibers won't be sending any signals. But now let's just say that we cause an error in the extrafusal fibers and we start to stretch them. So the extrafusal fibers stretch. What happens to the intrafusal fibers? They start to stretch as well. Can you see them stretching a little bit? But is there any tension on the intrafusal fiber yet? There is no tension. There's no tension. There's no tension until I get to this point right here. And then if we stretch the intrafusal fibers, what happens to tension? It increases, right? All right, so what coactivation means is that when the extrafusal fibers contract and the muscle spindle apparatus gets shorter, right, the gamma motor neurons then cause the contraction of the intrafusal fibers, so they get shorter as well. So as soon as the muscle starts to stretch, right, that produces tension in the intrafusal fibers, and then that can send tension information to the central nervous system, whether it's an error or appropriate signal or whatever. So the extrafusal fibers and the intrafusal fibers have to contract together, because if there is a lot of slack in the intrafusal fibers, they can change their length a lot without changing tension, right? And it's that tension measurement that's important for coordinating your body motion. So both the intrafusal fibers and extrafusal fibers are co-activated in order to generate error signals for the central nervous system. All right, so it's the activity of these gamma motor neurons that maintain normal muscle tone. All right, so stimulation of the gamma motor neuron causes the intrafusal fibers to take up that slack so that they can always be measuring the proper amount of tension in your muscles. All right, so how can that be used, or how is that used in your body? Your book has a number of really good reflexes. I'm probably just going to go over two of them. The first one is a knee-jerk reflex or a monosynaptic stretch reflex. All right, and you've probably even done this in lab or had it done to you a number of times. And that is, if somebody taps your patellar ligament right here, that increases momentarily just a little pulse of tension applied to the patella. But attached to the patella is the tendon of the quadriceps. So the tension in the tendon of the quadriceps increases, and that's attached to the quadriceps. So that induces a little pulse of tension in the quadriceps. So the quadriceps starts to stretch, all right? But did you cause that stretching? Did that initiate in your brain your premotor cortex or your primary motor cortex? No, that was something, right, that's from outside your body. All right? So it shouldn't be happening. And because of coactivation, the intrafusal fibers then are stretched as well, so they're going to send action potentials via sensory neuron into the spinal cord, and they are automatically wired up via one synapse to an alpha motor neuron, which then sends action potentials to the extrafusal fibers to resist that stretching. And what's going to happen, this muscle is going to contract to resist that stretching that was artificially applied, okay? And that mechanism is there to protect basically your knee joint and your hip joint and all the other joints in your leg. All right, so this doesn't even require an association neuron. This happens, all right, so the integration center is just hardwired in at the level of the spinal cord. And do you have any perception of what's happening inside your spinal cord? Do you have any consciousness at all? No. So this reflex happens without your conscious understanding of what's going on. And you can see that it happens very rapidly. So reflexes happen very rapidly without conscious appreciation to protect various parts of your body. All right, but as this sensory signal comes into the spinal cord, there are other association neurons then that get stimulated and take that signal up to the brain, because obviously you are aware when your leg contracts after somebody taps your knee, right? But that happens even after your leg muscles contract. Okay, so reflexes happen very, very quickly, and it doesn't even take time for you to appreciate and make a decision, conscious decision as to what's going on. So this is what we call the knee-jerk reflex. That protects from what? Overstretching of muscles. Okay. Here is another reflex. This is a Golgi tendon organ reflex, and this is a little bit different. All right. The first one causes what? A contraction of this muscle. The Golgi tendon reflex actually produces the opposite kind of effect, and it does require an association neuron, so it requires one more neuron. So Golgi tendon organs are at the interface between a tendon and the muscle itself, and when muscle is stretched, then action potentials are sent through this sensory neuron, right, in through the dorsal root, and let's talk about the stimulus in particular right here that's going to stretch this Golgi tendon organ. Well, let me see if I can give you maybe a couple examples. Maybe you need to lift a real heavy TV set or a couch or something or a bed around your house, all right? And could you lift a bed up all by yourself? No, it's a lot easier with two people, right? One person on one end, another person on the other end, or maybe even three or four people if it's something really, really heavy. And so two of you lift the object up, and you start walking around, you're going to move the couch someplace, and then all of a sudden, who's ever helping you, the couch slips out of their hand, okay, and it starts to fall to the floor. And so what are you experiencing at that point in time? After who's ever helping you lets go of the couch, could be by accident, what are you left holding? You're left holding the whole couch, the whole weight of the couch, okay, which is maybe now heavy enough to damage muscles and to pull tendons out of bones and things of that nature. So all of a sudden, this Golgi tendon organ right here experiences a huge pulse of tension, right? And enough tension that it's going to damage this tendon right here and this muscle, right? So that sends a flurry of action potentials to the central nervous system, where it stimulates an association neuron, right? What's another name for an association neuron? An interneuron. And this particular interneuron is not excitatory, it is inhibitory. right? So the sensory neuron excites this inhibitory association neuron, and it releases inhibitory neurotransmitter on this alpha motor neuron. All right, so what happens to action potentials coming down this alpha motor neuron? They're stopped, right? But what does this muscle need to contract? It needs action potentials. So as action potentials are stopped, what happens to that muscle? The muscle relaxes, and then as a result of that, you drop the couch as well, and that protects your body from being ripped apart. All right, so the Golgi tendon organ reflex is a little bit different than the knee-jerk reflex, but it's there to protect ligaments and tendons and muscles from overstretching, okay, by relaxing that muscle because it's using this inhibitory interneuron right here. All right, so the Golgi tendon organ reflex prevents excessive muscle contraction or passive muscle stretching. Now, probably somebody wouldn't ever do this, but does anybody know how heavy a car battery is? Really heavy, okay? You probably couldn't, like, grab it like a book with one hand and lift it up. Maybe some people could. Okay, you probably need to have at least two hands, and then it's still a lot of weight. Well, sometimes when you go buy a battery, they have different sizes of batteries that you can look at, and you can look at them, but there's no battery on the inside. They're just a little plastic case, all right? So they're very, very light. You could probably lift them up with just your little finger. So another way that you could think of this Golgi tendon organ reflex is maybe I could walk into an automotive parts store and pick up one of those fake batteries, right, and walk out of the store just carrying it with one hand, and people that would know anything about batteries would say, oh, wow, that's pretty impressive, okay? And then I could say, well, here, why don't you feel how heavy that is, okay? I could give it to you, but before I give it to you, maybe I turn around and I switch out that battery with a really heavy one, a real one, and I give it to you, and so now you're thinking that it's really light, but it's what? Really heavy, and I give it to you, what's going to protect your body from being ripped apart? That Golgi tendon reflex right there. So all of a sudden, all those Golgi tendon organs, right, are experiencing that tremendous amount of tension, and without you even knowing about it, you're going to drop that battery before it damages any of your muscles. Okay, so that's quite a bit different than the knee-jerk reflex. Any question on reflexes? And again, reflexes happen quickly and automatically without your conscious awareness that they're going on. Okay, your book has a number of other reflexes that you might want to review. You might have a question maybe on a crossed extensor reflex, for instance, in your book. Okay, so what are the other kinds of muscles besides skeletal? You got cardiac and smooth. And what makes them different than skeletal muscle? Because they're under involuntary control. They're controlled by your autonomic nervous system, right? And we're going to look at some other differences too. All right, in cardiac muscle, the contractile apparatus is similar to skeletal muscle. And so what are you going to tell me? What's the contractile apparatus? What's the structural and functional unit of contraction in skeletal muscle? It's the sarcomere. Same thing for cardiac muscle. And so you should think of the overlap between actin and myosin. What are the endpoints of a sarcomere called? They're the Z-discs, right? So cardiac muscle has that same thing. So when we look at cardiac muscle underneath a microscope, we see striations because that's exactly what we see when we look at skeletal muscle as well. But what about the morphology of these cells right here? What makes them different than skeletal muscle? How do you know this is cardiac muscle and not skeletal? Okay. You know, you do see intercalated discs with a light microscope. I'm not sure you'd see the gap junctions, but you know from your education that an intercalated disc does have a gap junction in it. But what else is a bigger structure, a bigger histological feature of cardiac muscle that you can tell for sure it's cardiac muscle and not skeletal muscle? It's branched, that's right. All right, so, and also because you can see the intercalated disc, you can see that cardiac muscle is relatively short and it is branched. All right, and the intercalated disc have a couple of different functions because since these muscles aren't very long, when this muscle cell contracts, it has to pull on this muscle cell, right? And in order to develop tension across the whole heart muscle, then these two muscle cells shouldn't pull apart from each other, because if they pull apart, then the heart isn't going to be able to develop any tension to pump blood. So intercalated discs have special junctions so that these cells don't pull apart, right? So they keep attached to each other, but it also has another feature, and that is a gap junction between them. And so what is the purpose of that gap junction again? It's a special kind of synapse. What kind of synapse is that? And a synapse is used for what? For allowing communication from one cell to another cell, right? And so so what kind of synapse is a gap junction? Your book doesn't make a big point of this. It's an electrical synapse. It's not a chemical synapse, right? It's an electrical synapse, so that when this cell over here receives a stimulus, an electrical stimulus, where does that electrical stimulus go? It flows into the neighboring cell. And from that cell, it flows into other neighboring cells, and that electrical signal then flows into what? The whole myocardium as a result of these gap junctions. All right, so what kind of signal is typically what we think of as a stimulus? Okay, yeah, well, an action potential has got two parts to it. The stimulus is kind of the first part, which is what? Due to? The stimulus is what? Depolarization. Okay, what does depolarization usually do to?
Sodium
going in the cell, that's right. So when this first cell becomes stimulated, it depolarizes, and then there's a sodium current that goes through the gap junction, which depolarizes this cell, and then those sodium currents go through all these gap junctions. All right, so what's important to see why cardiac muscle is branched, so not only is stimulation proceeds along in one level of the heart, okay, maybe in a longitudinal sense from the base of the heart down to the apex of the heart, but it also flows from the superficial layer into even the deeper layers of the heart because these fibers are branched. All right, so if we stimulate this cell right here, it not only moves laterally, right, maybe down to the apex, but it also moves from the subepicardium down into the subendocardium of the heart, right? It moves through the whole wall thickness. So all of the muscle fibers contract throughout the whole wall thickness, and so that's why these myocardial cells are branched. Okay, so we don't see that with skeletal muscle.
So the electrical signal will go like around, or is there no gap junction between like the top and the bottom?
Okay, just because we didn't, whoever drew this didn't draw enough of the cells to see.
So
but say for instance, here's, can you see a beginning of a branch right here? Maybe just a little bit. So here's a branch, and then there's going to be a gap junction here down into this cell. And then over here, it's going to flow down, and we see gap junctions over here. And so it's going to flow not only left and right, but it's going to flow up and down throughout the whole wall thickness of the heart. So that's important because how do we want our heart to contract? We want it to contract as a unit, okay? And it can happen because of these gap junctions. All right, so cardiac muscle is kind of the same in some other respects compared to skeletal muscle, in that there are voltage-gated sodium channels, right? And what's the function of a voltage-gated sodium channel? It's for depolarization, and that's the first part of an action potential. So cardiac muscle cells can propagate action potentials over their cell membrane, just like a skeletal muscle can. And action potentials can even dive down deep within the interior part of a myocardial cell because there are T-tubules, just like we do have in skeletal muscle, which have voltage-gated channels. But now here there's a little bit of a difference in excitation-contraction coupling. In cardiac muscle, okay, there are voltage-gated calcium channels that open up when this area of the membrane depolarizes, and that allows extracellular calcium, because calcium is high on the outside of the cell, allows that calcium to enter the myocardial cell. Okay, now here's the difference. There is no ryanodine receptor. There is no mechanical coupling between the calcium channels in the T-tubule membrane and the calcium-induced calcium release channel, which is embedded in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so these channels right here just change their state. They open up when there is an increase in calcium from outside the cell. And don't forget, these channels are very big, 10 times the diameter of the normal voltage-gated calcium channel. So as soon as these open up, there's a tremendous rush of calcium, right, throughout the whole myocardial cell. And again, that calcium is going to bind to troponin, and that's going to allow for cross-bridge cycling. And when cross-bridge is cycled, that allows for what, the sliding of the myofilaments over each other. Right, so the big difference inside between the skeletal muscle and myocardial cell is that there's no ryanodine receptor, but it still uses a calcium signal, and the majority of that calcium signal comes from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is where? Inside the myocardial cell. So there's a lot of similarity between skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle. All right, and where does that calcium signal bind? What kind of myofilament? Right, the controlling element. Right, so calcium is going to control sliding of the myofilaments. What is it binding to? What is it really changing? What's it controlling? Which filament is it acting on? Of the sarcomere. Okay, it's binding to troponin. Where do we find troponin? Is it on? What I'm asking is it on actin or is it on myosin? Okay, so troponin is a part of the actin filament, right? It's a part of the actin myofilament. And is that the same for skeletal muscle? As a matter of fact, it is. So that's another similarity. Okay. And then the cardiac muscle relaxes when this calcium ATPase pumps calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and then these filaments then slide back past each other, and the heart relaxes as a result. Okay, so you see some similarities with skeletal muscle. The next kind of muscle that we're going to look at. Oh, the other thing is though, there's a big difference though between cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle, and that is, what does skeletal muscle need in order to initiate contraction? It needs a signal from a motor neuron, right? It needs some kind of depolarizing signal from a neurotransmitter, from a motor neuron. What's a neurotransmitter that's used? Acetylcholine, right, is always stimulatory. It always opens sodium channels. But for cardiac muscle, it does not need innervation to contract. It is autorhythmic. And when we get to the next chapter, we're going to see why it is that a muscle cell can contract all by itself, even without innervation. But it does have dual innervation from the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system that's going to control the rate of contraction. All right, but you'll have to wait for the next chapter to see that. All right, so that's, a pretty big difference between skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle. Heart muscle does not need nerves to contract, but what about skeletal muscle? Does skeletal muscle need nerves to contract? Absolutely, right? Won't contract without it. All right, smooth muscle. Here is an example of smooth muscle. And do you see any sarcomeres? Do you see any striations? A big difference in smooth muscle compared to the other kinds of muscle types that we've looked at so far. All right, so if you don't see striations, what is missing from a smooth muscle? It doesn't have a sarcomere. It does have myosin and actin. It does rely on sliding of filaments, myosin and actin filaments, over each other for contraction, but it does not have a sarcomere. So it has a little bit different arrangement, a little bit different mechanism. Okay, some smooth muscle has gap junctions between them, and some don't, depending on the kind of smooth muscle, and I'll tell you which one does and which one doesn't, maybe on the next slide. And smooth muscle contains a lot more actin than myosin. Right? The myosin is a little bit thicker. Notice that the myosin head groups are arranged much more closely to each other, much more tightly packed, and it's surrounded with more actin molecules as well. All right, so in cardiac and skeletal muscle, what is the actin molecule anchored to? What is actin anchored to within skeletal and cardiac? Yeah, the Z-disc, the endpoints of a sarcomere, right? Actin is attached to the Z-disc, but since there are no sarcomeres in smooth muscle, actin isn't attached to a Z-disc because there are no Z-discs. But nonetheless, we have myosin, right, in the middle, and we have actin on the ends. Actin is still attached to something, but it's not to a Z-disc that's inside a myofibril. It's attached to a dense body, which is an integral protein of the cell membrane. So the actin molecules are attached to these little nodes on the cell membrane, and we call these dense bodies. All right, and so when actin and myosin slide past each other, then the distance between these dense bodies decreases. They approximate each other, right? So this one decreases, the distance between this dense body and this dense body decreases, and between this one and this one. So what happens to the overall shape of the cell? It turns in from a really elongated football to one that kind of looks like a football, which is what? A lot shorter. So that's how a smooth muscle cell contracts. It gets shorter because the cell membrane gets pulled together on the surface of the cell, not from something that's happening on the interior of the cell. And so this actually allows for, there's an advantage to that, greater stretching and contracting of a muscle cell. So these smooth muscles can contract to a greater degree compared to skeletal muscle. Okay, let me see what the next slide is. Okay, now there's something else too, and that is, where is the ATPase located? Is it located on an actin or a myosin molecule? Myosin, the same thing for skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle. The myosin head right here contains the ATPase, which what energizes the sliding of the myofilaments. The ATPase for smooth muscle is very slow. It can't catalyze the reaction as fast as ATPase on myosin in cardiac and skeletal muscle. So what can you tell me about contraction of a smooth muscle cell? It's much more slower, right? It is certainly much slower than cardiac or skeletal muscle. Once it's stimulated, it might take a second to contract, maybe even 2 seconds, because the ATPase is so slow. Okay. Plus, we'll see some other things that are happening here as well. All right, so smooth muscle contraction is controlled by calcium, just like we see in skeletal and cardiac muscle, but it's a little bit different. Smooth muscle doesn't really have much in the way of sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so there is no big reservoir of calcium inside the smooth muscle cell. All right, so it can't release calcium to cause the filaments to slide over each other. Smooth muscle also does not have troponin or tropomyosin covering the actin myofilaments. All right, but nonetheless, calcium is still an important signal for contraction of a smooth muscle. The signal doesn't come from sarcoplasmic reticulum, but it comes from outside the cell. It's extracellular. All right, so when a smooth muscle cell depolarizes, then there are calcium channels in the plasma membrane that open up that allow calcium to enter the cell from the extracellular fluid. So that's quite a bit different compared to skeletal and cardiac muscle. The other big difference is that since smooth muscle doesn't have troponin, it can't bind to troponin. It binds to another molecule, but you've heard of this one before, and that is calmodulin. So it binds to calmodulin, and then this calmodulin-calcium complex activates another enzyme that we call myosin light chain kinase. What can you tell me about myosin light chain kinase? You probably never heard of it before, but you can tell me what its action is. What is it going to do? It's going to phosphorylate something. All right, so myosin light chain kinase can run around the cell and phosphorylate something. And what it phosphorylates is myosin. It will phosphorylate the myosin head group, right? And as a result of that, then myosin can bind to the actin molecule and cross bridges can cycle when it is phosphorylated. All right, so activated myosin, it's activated by MLCK. Okay, then the filaments can slide over each other. So the mechanism for contraction is quite a bit different. The signal is still calcium, but that comes from outside the cell. Calcium doesn't bind to anything on actin. It just binds to calmodulin that activates an enzyme, then that activates myosin. So that's quite a bit different than cardiac and skeletal muscle because the controlling element, all right, is what? Calcium binding to actin. But what changes in smooth muscle is what? The myosin molecule, not the actin molecule. So that's really a different kind of mechanism altogether. All right, then relaxation occurs when calcium concentration decreases because there are calcium ATP pumps in the cell membrane. All right, and when that happens, myosin is dephosphorylated by myosin phosphatase. Myosin phosphatase is always active inside the cell, so there's always a balance between myosin phosphatase and what other enzyme? The myosin light chain kinase. So these two are always in balance, and if one wins out, there's relaxation. If the other one wins out, then there is contraction of the muscle cell. Okay. Smooth muscle, as I said, is always a lot slower than striated and cardiac muscle. The other interesting thing about smooth muscle is that it can form a state of prolonged contraction or binding of myosin to actin without the use of energy. We call that the latch state. Right, so that's almost kind of reminds me of like rigor mortis, right? Because ATP allows for what, the unbinding of myosin to actin in skeletal and cardiac muscle. But you could probably imagine this is a really good thing, because I can envision some smooth muscles that need to contract for a month at a time without relaxing, or maybe 2 months, or maybe 3 months, or maybe 4 months. Can anybody see where I'm going? Maybe 5 months. Maybe even 6 months without relaxing. Where should I stop? Somewhere around 9 months. Okay? So what kind of smooth muscle might have to contract for 9 months without relaxing? And it's probably the strongest muscle in the human body, and that is, yeah, the cervical muscle of the uterus, right, to maintain pregnancy. Because you don't want that muscle relaxing during gestation. Okay, so that's very useful. All right, so here is an exam figure. And this describes smooth muscle contraction. All right, so here we have a plot of what? Membrane voltage or membrane potential versus time. And this particular, what can you tell me about resting membrane potential without some kind of stimulus? Is it constant or is it changing?
Constant.
Ah, but let's look at, here is a plot of what? Membrane potential. If it was constant, what would this, it kind of looks like a blue line. The blue line would be flat. But is it flat? It's going up and down. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
That means that, yeah, it means that it's actually changing without any kind of stimulus, right? So, and as a matter of fact, if you have a resting membrane potential and it moves up to here, what do we call that? Is that depolarization, repolarization, or hyperpolarization, or am I just lost? That's called depolarization, right? So the membrane is depolarizing, and what is it doing? It is spontaneously depolarizing, all right, and then it does what? It, and then it repolarizes, okay, it repolarizes, and then what does it do? It depolarizes, and then what does it do again? It repolarizes, all right, and, but don't forget, smooth muscle does have voltage-gated channels on it, and if the depolarization reaches a sufficient level, which we call threshold, what happens? Action potentials, right? These action potentials are all the same. So some smooth muscle is autorhythmic, and it depolarizes on its own, and the depolarization can build up over time, and when it reaches threshold, it produces action potentials, and what does that do? Well, that's sufficient. That threshold depolarization then triggers voltage-gated calcium channels, and that means what? Calcium can enter the cell because there's high calcium outside the cell. Calcium then binds to calmodulin, right? And then that complex can activate an inactive MLCK by dephosphorylating it. When it's dephosphorylating, or when MLCK is dephosphorylated, then it acts as a kinase, and it can phosphorylate myosin. So myosin becomes phosphorylated, and when myosin is phosphorylated, that's when cross bridges can form. So that's when it can bind to actin, that's when it can use ATP, okay, to force sliding of the actin and myosin filaments over each other. All right, so can you see there's no tropomyosin here, there's no troponin, it's what, just this calmodulin complex that can activate myosin to cause sliding of the filaments. All right, and when the muscle relaxes, of course, then calcium is pumped back out of the cell, myosin light chain kinase becomes inactive, and then this enzyme takes over, myosin phosphatase. What does phosphatase do? It dephosphorylates myosin, the light chain of myosin, and when it's dephosphorylated, it becomes inactivated, and then the smooth muscle can relax. So this mechanism is quite a bit different than what we have seen in cardiac and skeletal muscle. All right, so this could be a picture on the next test. All right, so smooth muscle, there are basically two kinds, two general kinds of smooth muscle. There's something called single unit, and then there's something called multi-unit. Single unit is a kind of smooth muscle that contracts as a unit. So even though you might have an organ made up of thousands of smooth muscle cells. When one contracts, guess what happens? They all contract. And what kind of structural feature would you use to explain how that would happen? If you depolarize one smooth muscle cell, why is it that all the cells within that neighborhood are going to contract? Because of electrical synapses, namely due to gap junctions. That's right. So single unit smooth muscle has gap junctions. It also so happens that single unit smooth muscle typically is spontaneously active. We call that myogenic. Myo mean muscle is that it can contract on its own, just like on that previous slide. This would be an example of what? A myogenic smooth muscle. It is autorhythmic. It generates its own spontaneous activity. All right, and some cells depolarize to a greater degree than others in a neighborhood, and if some cells depolarize to a greater degree than others, they become pacemakers, right? Because as soon as they reach threshold and action potentials are initiated in a pacemaker cell, then all of the cells will depolarize as a result. So you maybe, where else have you heard of an organ that has a pacemaker in it? But the heart. But the heart isn't smooth muscle, it's cardiac muscle. So again, there's a similarity between smooth muscle and cardiac muscle. Okay, and so we explain that because there are gap junctions that spread electrical activity throughout the whole neighborhood. Multi-unit smooth muscle requires nerve stimulation by the autonomic nervous system. It's not myogenic. Neurotransmitters are released along, not from an axon terminus, but from varicosities along a whole extent of the axon. It kind of looks like a string of pearls, and sometimes we call that what? Synapses in passant, or synapses in passing. And that's what we see on this slide right here. So we have a couple examples of single unit smooth muscle and multi-unit smooth muscle. Autonomic innervation of single unit smooth muscle still can influence its autorhythmicity, but it's not necessary for contraction. We know this is single unit smooth muscle because of why? We see gap junctions between these cells. So only one cell needs to depolarize or reach threshold, and then all of the cells in this neighborhood are going to contract. But for multi-unit smooth muscle, all right, we see that it usually has dual innervation, okay, from an autonomic neuron. What are the two classes that would cause dual innervation? Sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. So one might be releasing acetylcholine, the other is going to be releasing norepinephrine. One might be excitatory, the other might be inhibitory because of the different receptors in these cells. And so you can see that if this cell contracts, it's not going to cause contraction of this cell over here, right, because there are no gap junctions. So we call this a multi-unit smooth muscle. All right, and depending on the balance of excitatory and inhibitory neurotransmitter, this muscle cell, the smooth muscle cell, can make a decision whether it's going to contract and to what degree it's going to contract. All right, so smooth muscle can make a decision on what to do. What about skeletal muscle? Can skeletal muscle ever make a decision on what to do if a neurotransmitter is released on it? No. As soon as that alpha motor neuron releases acetylcholine, that muscle cell is going to contract to its best ability to do that. Not so with smooth muscle, because it's always going to be a balance between the different divisions of the autonomic nervous system. All right, so that's a nice comparison and contrast of the different kinds of muscles that we have in our body. All right, so that's it for muscle. Yeesh, I must be talking really slow this semester. Does it sound like I'm asleep or anything? No? Okay. All right, well, let's move on to the next chapter. So let's see, what time is it? Oh, yeah, plenty of time. Okay. All right, so here we're going to talk about blood, a little bit about the heart, and then some about the circulation. But you know what? A lot of this chapter you should already know from taking a human anatomy class. So a lot of this chapter is review. So I'm not going to review it for you in lecture, but you do have to review it if you can't remember things about the heart. Like, for instance, how many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does the heart have? Well, ooh, I see some confusion on that part. That should be really easy. Okay, yeah, it has four chambers, and the heart has four valves, and then you got to know what there's two atrial ventricular valves, two semilunar valves, know something about the structure of those valves, right? Okay. So these are all the things that you should know. I'm going to talk about blood, pulmonary and systemic circulation. I'm not going to talk very much about. I don't think that's something you should know from anatomy, but I will talk something about the cardiac cycle, electrical activity of the heart, and then I won't talk about structure of blood vessels, or just maybe just a little bit, because you should know a lot about blood vessels already. But I did include slides for you to help review that information. Or if you want to see me during office hours to help review some of that stuff, I'd be happy to do that. All right, so what's the function of the circulatory system? Well, it's there. What kind, well, I'll tell you what. Since we're going to talk about blood first, what kind of tissue is blood? It's connective tissue. It's kind of a funny connective tissue. Why? Because usually I think, like, what kind of connective tissue is bone? It's a hard, solid connective tissue, but what about blood? It's a fluid connective tissue, so it flows, right? But we call it a connective tissue because it connects different parts of your body together. So it's a connective tissue that transports oxygen, nutrients, enzymes, hormones to tissues, so it's a delivery system to tissues. But it's also a transport system, a delivery system away from tissues. What is it we need to deliver away from tissues? Carbon dioxide, waste products, right, need to be taken away from the tissues. But not only chemicals are transported in the blood, but there's something a little bit more ethereal, and that is heat is transported in the body. So it's important for heat transfer. Certain parts of your body will be generating a lot of heat. For instance, when you exercise a muscle, and it might cause hypothermia in that muscle and cause fatigue. That heat is taken away from the muscle by the blood and delivered to the skin where you radiate it out of your body, and then that's a way to maintain temperature homeostasis. So heat transfer in your body is real important, function of blood. Blood also maintains fluid balance and electrolyte balance and pH balance in your body. pH is just sort of a fancy electrolyte. What is pH really a measure of? Hydrogen ion concentration, don't forget that's an ion, but because the hydrogen ion concentration is so important in influencing chemical reactions, right, your body has to maintain pH balance or pH homeostasis. Can your pH change very much? No, it shouldn't. 7.35, you're a little basic. So if your pH of your blood were to change right now, normally from 7.35 maybe to 7.25, does that seem like a very big change? No, but you know what? That probably would be enough to be fatal if that were to happen in just a couple minutes. All right. If that happened over a course of a week or a month or something, your body could adjust, but even a small change like that could be very devastating to you. So the blood is real important in that respect. But your blood also protects your body from disease-causing microorganisms and foreign substances. And even tumors. And we probably all had numerous kinds of tumors in our body, but our immune system was able to identify those tumors and kill them before they became clinically significant. So there are certain cells and certain things in your blood that will maintain that healthy state. And then the last function of blood is that since blood is a fluid, and if you damage or put a hole in a blood vessel, what is blood going to do? It's going to run out, but if it's a high-pressure vessel, what kind of vessel has high pressure in it? Like an artery, if you put a hole in an artery, it's not going to just dribble out, it's going to come squirting out of your body, right? So it's important for your body to know how to prevent blood loss. So that's another important function. Prevention of blood loss when a blood vessel is damaged, that's another real important function of blood, because you don't want to give any blood away. All right, so what are the components of the circulatory system? Well, we have the cardiovascular system, which means what? The heart, as well as blood vessels. All right, and we know there are some things called arteries, some smaller things called arterioles, and we got capillaries, venules, and veins. So can anybody tell me what a good definition of an artery is? What is an artery? That's a nice thing you should know from anatomy. It carries blood away from the heart. That's right. So could you have an artery that carries oxygen? Yeah. Give me an example of an artery that carries oxygen. The aorta. Could you have an artery that carries predominantly CO2 and not oxygen? Yeah. As a matter of fact, and what's the name of that artery? That's the pulmonary artery, right? So what the vessel is carrying doesn't define whether it's an artery or a vein. It's only the direction of that flow. And if blood flow is flowing away from the heart, that's always an artery, right? Consequently, everything that's flowing to the heart is, or all the blood that's flowing to the heart is carried to the heart by a vein. And there are some veins that are high in oxygen. Like what veins are high in oxygen? Where's the blood coming back from? Your lungs. And so we call that a pulmonary vein, right? Because blood goes to the lungs to pick up oxygen. Well, I see you got to review that a little bit. Okay. All right, so you should know about the heart, the structure of the heart. You should know something about the structure of these blood vessels right here. Which kind of vessel allows for exchange?
Capillaries.
Only capillaries. And do you know why exchange can only take place in capillaries? Because that's the only kind of blood vessel that's thin enough to allow for diffusion to take place. Arteries and veins are way too thick to allow material to enter or leave a blood vessel. All right, so that's just some other things maybe to look at when you open up your anatomy books and review a little bit. All right, so that's cardiovascular system, heart and blood vessels, including all of these vessels right here. And it also includes the lymphatic system. All right, and the lymphatic system takes tissue fluid, which originated from a capillary, which means that it came out of your vascular system. That fluid leaves a capillary and gets stuck in tissue spaces or spaces between cells. And what would happen to you if that fluid were to build up and never be returned to your vascular system? You'd swell up and swell up and swell up, and we call that edema. That doesn't happen under normal circumstances. That fluid is returned to the vascular system via some other vessels that we call lymphatic vessels. So your lymphatic system captures that excess tissue fluid and returns it to veins before it enters the heart so that you don't become dehydrated or that you become all swollen up. And as that lymph returns, so that excess tissue fluid, once it enters a lymphatic blood and a lymphatic vessel, that becomes lymph. And when lymph then goes back to the circulatory system, it's filtered by a series of filters that we call lymph nodes. So these are all parts of the cardiovascular system. Okay, well, let's look at blood. What the heck is blood? If you were to donate blood and someone were to take blood out of your body through maybe a vein in your arm, that product is what we call whole blood because it's got everything that blood has in it, right? So, but we got to understand what's in that blood. You have a total volume of about 5 liters, and there are two major compartments or components that make up blood. The first part is plasma. Plasma is the fluid part, right? That's the part that flows. And then the second part are what we call formed elements. And formed elements really are cells. Okay, and cells are suspended in plasma. Plasma then can be broken down into water, right? Because we're all basically all dissolved in water. The remaining part, 8%, are made up of proteins. And then we got a number of different kinds of proteins in blood. There are albumins. We've got globulins and clotting factors. Right, these clotting factors help prevent blood loss. These albumins right here are there for water balance. Let me just draw this on the board real quick. Okay, so if we have two compartments right here with a semi-permeable membrane so that water can move across this membrane, all right, and then here is blood right here, and then here is just tissue fluid right here, and blood has a lot of albumin. So I'm just going to diagram it as Al, Al, and what? We got a little sodium, maybe a little chlorine right here. And over in tissue fluid, we don't have any albumin. We only have a little bit of sodium and a little bit of chloride. Which way is water going to go? Is that obvious? Which way is water going to go? It's going to go from, okay, in terms of osmotic pressure, it's going to go from tissue fluid back into the blood. And where can that happen? What kind of blood vessel? A capillary, right? So the liver's, one of the job of the liver is to make a lot of albumin so that a capillary can resorb a lot of tissue fluid. And so what happens to a liver when it becomes damaged and it can no longer produce all these albumin proteins Or maybe there's maybe kidney damage and you start to lose these albumins in urine. Okay, and you just pee it out of your body. What happens to tissue fluid? Okay, well, albumin is drawing fluid back into the blood at a capillary, and if these albumins go away, then that fluid stays in the tissues, and that produces an edema. All right, and the liver is what produces all these albumins, and that's necessary, right? So there are a lot of albumins in blood to maintain fluid balance in your body so that you don't swell up. What about these globulins right here? Well, they're important for fighting infections, but we also saw that they transport hydrophobic compounds like, what, tetraiodothreonine, because it's not soluble in water. It has to bind to a globulin, which then solubilizes insoluble hormones or other kinds of hydrophobic molecules. The other components of plasma are ions, like, what's a good ion? What's your favorite ion? Chlorine, okay. Sodium, potassium, all those things are ions, right? Magnesium. Nutrients, what's your favorite nutrient? Well, it's got to be glucose, right? Okay, then gases, for instance, like carbon dioxide, maybe a little bit of oxygen. Oxygen does not like to dissolve in plasma. CO2 does, but oxygen doesn't, has different properties, right? So in order for blood to transport oxygen, you can't just have plasma, right? And we're going to see what parts of blood can transport oxygen. And then waste products are also transported by plasma, like urea, for instance. All right, well, if we have, so clotting factors, there are things within the plasma that can coagulate blood, that can form a blood clot. All right, so if we take plasma and take out the clotting factors, we're left with what? All these water and all these normal proteins, ions, nutrients, and gases. But plasma can't congeal at all, and that's what we call serum. Right, so serum is plasma minus all of the factors that allow for clotting to take place, which means what? There are globulins that fight infections within serum. So a lot of times maybe if somebody has an insect bite or has been envenomated by a snake or some kind of insect, maybe like a black widow spider or something, right? We can give them a serum that has what? Antibodies to those venoms, and so sometimes we call those anti-sera. Right? Maybe you've heard of anti-serum. And so a serum is just what? It's just basically plasma that has all the good stuff that normal plasma has, except what? Clotting factors. It's not going to cause any kind of clotting abnormality if we were to give that to somebody. Okay, what about formed elements? Most of the formed elements are red blood cells, and they're anucleate. They don't contain a nucleus at all. Another name for them is an erythrocyte. Guess what erythro means? It means red. What language is that? I don't know, probably Latin. Well, it's Latin or Greek. I'm not sure. All right, erythro. Then we also have white blood cells, but notice that that's a very small percentage, less than 1% of all formed elements in the blood. These are nucleated. You can see nuclei in white blood cells. We call these leukocytes. Guess what leuko means? It means white. That's exactly right. So maybe another example I use, what's the animal symbol of the United States of America? It's a bird. It's a big bird. What bird is it? Well, it's an eagle. What kind of eagle is it? It's a bald eagle. Now, is this guy really bald? The gals look the same way. No, they're not really bald. They have feathers. What color are their feathers? They're white, so they kind of look bald, right? So they're called a bald eagle because they have white feathers on their head. Guess what their scientific name is? Leuko-something. Yeah, you're exactly right. They're called leukocephalus for head. It's a great white-headed bird, right? So don't forget, leuko means white. And then platelets make up a fairly large fraction of blood, or the formed elements. I should say 5%. These are anucleate. These are very small. Sometimes we call these thrombocytes because they can produce, they help blood clotting. All right, so you got to be familiar with these different things. An important clinical measurement is of a hematocrit, right? And the hematocrit is just the percentage of red blood cells that we find in whole blood. What's whole blood? Everything that's in blood, right? And if we measure the amount or the volume of red blood cells and we know the amount of whole blood, then we can calculate the hematocrit. All right, and it's different between men and women. It's higher in men. That means that men have typically higher number of red blood cells as a percentage to women. probably a whole bunch of reasons for that. But anyway, so if we were to take a whole blood sample and put it in a test tube and let it sit overnight, all the heavy stuff would fall to the bottom of the test tube. And what would be the heavy stuff? All the cells, the formed elements, right? Okay, and then all the light stuff would float to the top, and that would be plasma. But if you don't want to wait overnight, what can you do? You can take that test tube and put it in a centrifuge and spin it down for about a minute or so, and then all the formed elements will fall to the bottom. So the hematocrit is just the volume of red blood cells compared to the whole volume of whole blood. So if we look at this, what would you say the hematocrit is 50%? Even if you just eyeball it, does it look 50%? This volume of red blood cells, does it look less than 50%? Yeah. So, you know, this is what, maybe 45%, something. So that's really what hematocrit is. It's just the volume of red blood cells compared to the volume of whole blood. All right, so here you can see nice red blood cells. These are white blood cells. Red blood cells have a pigment in them called hemoglobin. And these little guys over here are platelets. These are cell fragments, but because they're surrounded by a cell membrane, we still call it a formed element. So because red blood cells really don't look like a cell because they don't have a nucleus, what do we call all of these particles here? We call these formed elements, but they're sort of cellular in nature, but they don't really conform to a typical understanding of a cell. All right, so here I have a question for you to work on, and that is, if you have an 80 milliliter sample, milliliter is what, a volume of something, right? It's a cubic centimeter. If you have an 80 ml sample of whole blood from a normal individual, right, and it contains 30 ml of erythrocytes and 0.72 milliliters of leukocytes and 4 ml of thrombocytes after centrifuging, so it's going to look like this, is a sample from a man or a woman? So get your calculator out. A lot of you probably can just do this in your head. All right, just by doing some kind of graphical method, but make sure you know how to calculate a hematocrit, okay, by looking at that. And if it doesn't make sense to you, ask your lab instructor or work in after lab, break down into a group and make sure that you can calculate hematocrit, okay? It is not difficult to do. All right, so I guess that's going to be it for today. Yeah. I'm not going to tell you. You got to calculate it, okay? And if you really want me to tell you, maybe next, I won't even tell you next time. I'll let you at least work on it over the weekend, okay? Okay, but work on it in lab a little bit. Okay, see you next time. Oh, where's the sign-in sheet at? Don't forget the sign-in sheet is down over here.